This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at UH1.com.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst, and making a welcome return, Tony Hodgson of The Coach's Voice. It's one of the milestone matches of the season, a repeat of the Champions League final at the end of May. Manchester City have a lot to prove at Stamford Bridge. Chelsea, by contrast, are flying. A lot of the focus will be on the two managers. Comparisons will be made, reputations reinforced. Tony, you spend a lot of time with elite coaches. Has Thomas Tuchel got inside Pep Guardiola's head?
Morning, Mike, first and foremost. Thanks for having me back. I think to get into Pep Guardiola's head, you've got to push Pep Guardiola out of his own head. And I'm not sure anyone can do that. I think definitely on the evidence of what we saw last season, if anyone's got inside Pep's head, it's Tuchel. Chelsea were beaten three times, of course, under Tuchel. Once in the league, once in the FA Cup, and then again in the Champions League. And actually, I think the Champions League games was the most decisive of the three. And again, at the time, everyone looked at the selection that Pep made without Rodri or Fernandinho. And if you look at the first game they played under Tuchel, Rodri and Fernandinho both played. If you look at the second game, Rodri played. And everyone's like, well, why wouldn't he change it around? They lost both games. Well, Manchester City are the best team in the league, were the best team in the league by some distance. But Pep has history for this, doesn't he, in the Champions League, in seemingly fiddling with something that isn't really broke and to the detriment of City's performance. And I think that's what we saw last season. I definitely think the Chelsea team under Tuchel are confident of beating anybody where they are right now. I thought their performance against Liverpool with 10 men was quite ominous for the rest of the league, actually. They seem in total control. And you can't help but think Chelsea going to this game as favourites.
Yeah, I suppose coaching is a bit of a cyclical profession, Aid. You know, trends are changing, clubs rise and fall. There is a sense that this is Tuchel's time, isn't there? He's probably got the same intensity as Pep, although, you know, he had his problems at other clubs, didn't he, in terms of personality issues. But he seems to have channeled everything much more positively at Chelsea.
Yeah, he's made a dream start. He's a coach at the very top of his game at the moment. I think that we can all see that. I love the energy of both of them. They've got so much to give, haven't they? They're packed with charisma. And I think that's a huge ingredient for managers and for coaches, because players, it's not just about tactics. It's not just about, you know, getting the team in the right formation or even just picking the right team. It's about extracting the best out of players and getting players to buy into you and want to play for you. And I think that those two, you know, have it in spades, and players feed off their energy and knowledge. They're both incredible. Tuchel, I would say, is slightly less stubborn than Pep in terms of when he's looking at a game, and they can both see matches and how, you know, what's going on. They can both see it so clearly, so quickly. They've got incredible minds. But I think that Pep Guardiola is still a little bit stubborn in terms of this is the way I wanted the game to go and this is the way that we're going to go. And I think he takes longer to make a change than Tuchel, who can see something's not working and will just rip it up and go to something else. We saw that against Spurs. So that's the difference right now between those two. But make no mistake, they're both sensational.
Do you think Tuchel's in-game management is a particular strength, Tony?
Yeah, I think he's just made the point that we saw that at the weekend. I also think what I know about Tuchel from sources is that he doesn't do a huge amount of coaching on the grass. He also is a fan of short and sharp team meetings. So he's
that'll go down well. Yeah.
Yeah, so you know, I think we, you know, all the time I've spent talking to coaches, communication and getting the message across, and understanding that players don't necessarily want to sit around and listen for hours on end to coaches. So I think Tuchel's just got, he's obviously got an incredible talent for getting his message across very quickly, very succinctly. And if you can do that in the build-up to a game, then you can also do that during a game. I also think you look at the Chelsea team now and it just has that feel, doesn't it, of the old Chelsea teams where it kind of manages itself to a degree. There's some really big leaders in there. Mendy's been a great signing. I mean, I know he missed the game at the weekend, but he's, you know, he's just really secure at the back. And then you've got people like Azpilicueta, Jorginho, Kante, obviously Lukaku's back. There's just a feeling that there's, you know, some senior pros in there who just don't panic. And I go back to that Liverpool game. Everyone went a bit crazy just before half time, but in the second half they set up. Tuchel made his changes, the players knew what they were doing, and they just looked in total control, even with 10 men. You know, I started the season thinking that City were going to walk the league, and I kind of think that Chelsea are probably favourites now, which is kind of shows a lot of what Tuchel's done.
Yeah, in terms of, you know, there's a real faith and experience, isn't there, Aidan? Thiago Silva, you know, we've mentioned on the pod in the past, you know, someone who's nearly 37 playing with the enthusiasm and intelligence that he does. Also, he backs his men, doesn't he? Marcos Alonso was on the outside looking in until he turned up.
Yeah, he was. And he's his own man, and you've given him a chance. And he's repaid that, hasn't he? I think what happened was that Lampard was in a position where he couldn't buy, but he'd sort of committed to the go young policy, which was great at the time. And it was probably the right thing to do at the time. But it did alienate one or two of the senior players and who he could maybe have used more often, as Tuchel has. But what I think Tuchel has done as well is profit from respect and from his CV, really, because those senior players, what you get with senior players is they will take notice, I think, of a coach's record. And with Lampard, I think he was always looking to prove himself to them as a coach. But the senior players at Chelsea know that Tuchel's good and they know he's fantastic and they want to buy into it because they want to win things. They've not got that long left in their careers, some of these guys. Average age the other day against Spurs was 28. So this is, you know, last 2-3 years at the highest level for some of them. They want those years to be the most successful and they want to be in the team. So they are pushing themselves like young players, young, hungry, impressionable players were pushing themselves for Lampard. I think that's the key difference.
Yeah. What about Guardiola, Tony? As I said, you know, coaches are your stock in trade. Is he still regarded as the coach's coach?
That's a really good question. I think he's probably still regarded, and rightly so, as a coaching genius. I think there are probably question marks over about his future at Manchester City. What he, you know, everything seems to be with Pep. Everything seems to centre on the Champions League, which is kind of crazy because of what he's done. I mean, they win the League Cup every season at a canter. They've won numerous league titles, only once really been pushed in that time by Liverpool. But it does feel, and Aid's kind of touched on it, right? It does feel like he's in his own head. It does feel like he wants to win things by doing things in a different way. He wants to seemingly not have a number nine, or he wants to, you know, he doesn't even want to have centre. I mean, he's kind of gone back to centre-backs now, but you just, it feels like he's so good, he's achieved so much, that it feels like he wants to test himself and give himself and kind of hamstring himself to show how good he is. And I just think, you look at Tuchel, he's made the point that he just has that, he's that, got that buy-in and respect to the players. Sometimes the noises out of Man City towards the back end of last season that all wasn't necessarily right. The players weren't necessarily believing in what Pep was doing in terms of changing the team, setting up the team. And then we've got the whole kind of chat around the captaincy this season, the kind of, you know, democracy, the vote. It just seems like, I mean, the wheels aren't coming off. Let's not get crazy about it. But it does just feel like things aren't quite right at Man City in the way that possibly they are at Chelsea at the moment.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, he is probably temperamentally unsuited to building a dynasty, you know, at City or anywhere else, come to think of it. He's also been a bit cloth-eared, if I can put it like that. You know, picking a unnecessary fight with fans. Now, after the Wigan game in the League Cup this week, he was very strident about saying that City should be able to put their under-23 squad in the Championship or League One. Now, that B team model is anathema to most people. What was your view on that, Aid?
Oh, no. I mean, not having that at all. I despise the notion of Premier League teams putting under-23 sides into the Football League. The Football League is precious. It's what makes English football so great, in my opinion. The depth of talent, you know, the pride that we have in the pyramid is something to cherish. And it would be tainted. It would be spoiled, in my opinion. You just have to look at the Papa John's trophy. I mean, no one cares. No one cares. No one turns up to watch the games, but the Premier League teams don't pick under-23s. They pick youth teams. Their best players are out on loan, getting experience in the league. I think that's better for them than playing, you know, in the league as part of an under-23 team personally. It's not better for Manchester City. I get why they would want to do it. They, you know, puts Man City under-23s in the Championship. What great practice that is for players to develop. But no, it's not worth ripping up, you know, over 100 years worth of history to do that, to suit them. So no, I don't like that. And, you know, there are quite a few things I don't like that Pep Guardiola says, but he is a genius. There's no denying that. His footballing mind works on a different plane to almost everybody else.
Which, you know, begs the question, who is of the required stature to succeed him? You know, you look at Tuchel, in taking his team to another level, he's highlighted the value of a truly elite coach, hasn't he, Tony? Mm. But by definition, there aren't many of those around. You know, look at what's going on at Barcelona at the moment with, you know, Koeman, you know, basically stalking out of a press conference after reading a prepared statement, which is never a good look. You know, Martinez, Xavi have been mentioned as replacements. Who is of that stature that can take over from Guardiola?
I mean, the simple answer is no one. I mean, but I mean, if you think about Tuchel, go back to Chelsea, it's probably quite unfashionable what I'm going to say here, but, you know, Lampard, it's easy to get. If you've got a problem with your plumbing in your house, do you want a plumber with 1 year experience or a plumber with 15 years experience coming to do it? That's in effect what Chelsea did when they went from Lampard to Tuchel. I think what Lampard achieved in his time at Chelsea was bringing through some young players, finishing top four, getting back into the Champions League, and then importantly qualifying from the group stage of the Champions League. There's no, you know, things weren't great. They didn't have a great run in the league. They were miles behind City, but the fact that he achieved that on the back of 1 year of coaching experience, actually, I think is incredibly impressive. Now, the question for Lampard is, where does he go now? And who knows? But going back to your question, you need somebody with that level of experience, you know, to come in and take on whatever Pep leaves. You need somebody with 10, 12, 15 years coaching experience. You're not going to get anyone like Pep. So the question mark then is do you go overseas? Do you try and tempt one of these, you know, at the minute, young German coaches are all the rage, and you know, I think we had a conference at the Coaches Voice a couple of weeks ago where Ralf Rangnick spoke. We've spoken about Rangnick before and the influence that he's had over kind of German coaches. So do you look to one of those? Can you tempt one of those younger guys? Kind of Marco Rose is doing okay. He might be interesting. But then do you look to the UK? Do you think someone like Brendan Rodgers, he's linked to all the top jobs, but people have mixed feelings about him. Do the City fans want someone like, do they expect somebody of the stature of Pep, who, again, we've discussed, like, who is that? I really don't know. It's a real challenge. You know, he's not been there for the length. Go on, Abe, go on.
I was just going to say, you know who I'd love to see there? It probably won't happen. Love to see Bielsa take charge of a team with as much quality as Manchester City, but with his methods, which are, you know, unique in their own right, aren't they? And the fitness levels, the complexity, really. I think City's players could handle the complexity of his tactical approach, but Yeah, that would be, that for me as a neutral would be like a dream appointment. I'd love to see it.
Actually, if you think about the City players and the kind of the issues that they reportedly had with some of Pep's fiddling with the system towards the end of last season, you're not going to get that with Bielsa, are you? He's going to stick to his principles and just keep on doing what he does.
I'll tell you one reason why it won't work, because Manchester City have 22 players that are on, you know, gazillion pounds a week that all want to play, and Bielsa only ever really wants to play 11 or 12 players, doesn't he? So that won't, it won't work because of that.
Yeah. Well, you hit on a point there, Aid, and, you know, one for you, Tony. Yeah, look across Manchester United, a big squad. I suppose the question is now, okay, United are out of the League Cup, which reduces the game time for fringe players. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's got a big squad there. A lot of players will be unhappy. Has he gotten the maturity to deal with that almost like human chemistry?
Another great question. I actually think he does have that. Question mark over Solskjaer is not about whether he's able to keep the morale of the squad up or maintain good relationships with players. It's about whether he's got the tactical nous to actually compete at the top end of the table in the really big games. I think United fans will be sick of people pointing to the Europa League final last season, but it felt like the team selection was based more on relationships with players than it was on picking a team to tactically win the game. And I mean, they still should have done, but there have to be question marks over his ability to really compete at the top end with some of these coaches. I mean, Pogba seems happier than he was under the previous manager, but the noises still keep coming every so often. I mean, Raiola just chirps away every so often. I don't know what you guys think, but I think when an agent's talking that regularly, he tends to be doing so with the blessing of the player.
Yeah, well, I think the latest lament was Pogba has got a cure in his heart. So obviously he's wooing Juventus. Aid, and I know, you know, we're doing exactly what I say we shouldn't do here, but why do we give him airtime for his sales pitches?
Well, he makes headlines, doesn't it? It's Paul Pogba's one of the most charismatic players in the Premier League, and his future is a constant source of debate. And it is interesting because, in one hand, he looks happy. He clearly likes Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. He's got 7 assists this season. He's playing really well, I think, in the main. Yet, where does he fit? You know, in the big games, when Manchester United need him to step up, he's actually the problem player, isn't it? It's like, can we trust him to play central midfield? Or do we have to crowbar him in on the left-hand side where he might produce a moment of magic? So it is a real awkward situation for him and for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. It could all have been solved, in my opinion, if they'd have invested in a world-class defensive midfielder, because then I just feel that you play Bruno and Pogba either side as sort of roaming number eights, a la Manchester City. That, I think, is what Solskjaer would love to do, but he doesn't have a good enough central midfielder to prop up those two. He just doesn't have one. And that means that for as long as Pogba is at United, or until January at least, in regards to the transfer market and who can come in, this problem is going to persist.
Yeah. Where does he play and how does he play Jadon Sancho, Tony?
I mean, I think in the formation that he's currently looking at, you play him on either side of the number nine of Ronaldo, but he's been there 5 minutes. I think obviously there's a huge price tag, and you know, he tore up a lot of trees in Germany. He's clearly a very, very good player. There's kind of this puzzle, isn't there, with the England setup. You know, I think people in Germany, German writers, German journalists, German fans, kind of like, why on earth is Sancho? How can Sancho not be starting for England? I think there's a natural caution with English fans because we just haven't really seen that much of him. So we still, I mean, it's crazy that for someone who achieved so much in Germany, you know, a young English guy going overseas and doing so well, which has not been done that often, really, let's face it, in recent times or ever. So I think it's just a matter of time. Like I personally would probably start him on the left because I'm a huge fan of Mason Greenwood. I love seeing him cutting off the right. And then, I mean, Ronaldo's obviously going to play. So that's probably what I'd go for. That doesn't leave much room for Marcus Rashford at the moment coming back. Obviously, Cavani is there, and Anthony Martial, who didn't really do much last night. So that's what I'd look at. And I just think, you know, he has to be given time. I think if you look at all how many players come in on big transfers and hit the ground running immediately in the Premier League, not many.
Mm. Aston Villa are at Old Trafford on Saturday lunchtime. I get the sense they're beginning to, it's almost coming together, Aid. What do you think?
Coming together in terms of the
well, just the team, yeah, because, okay, they've reinvested the 100 million they got for Grealish quite well. Leon Bailey is an obvious talent, but he seems a bit fragile. Buendia's come good as well. There's a team beginning to evolve is probably what I'm trying to say, very clumsily.
It's a new team. Yeah, it's a new team. Before it was the Jack Grealish show, wasn't it? And it wasn't anyone's fault that it was the Jack Grealish show. It was just that he was so much better than everybody else that it kind of had to be. But yeah, no, there have been a lot of change. Obviously, John Terry has gone as well, which is, you know, a big personality from within the dressing room. And yeah, I like the look of what Dean Smith is building on paper. I really do. I think that all of the signings are excellent. I think that Ings and Watkins could be terrific up front. I really do. That's a great partnership in the making. Bailey's exciting. Buendia, I do think, is ready to shine in the Premier League. And yeah, they'll have no fear of this game. Going to Old Trafford, they won at Leicester, Spurs, Arsenal, Leeds, Everton last season, narrowly lost at City, United and Liverpool. They're a good away team, Aston Villa. And yeah, there'll be no fear there. No, I like what they're doing. And of course, they've brought in a set-piece coach, which I'm sure Tony would be interested in discussing as well, Austin McPhee. It's all evolving behind the scenes and on the pitch as well at Villa Park.
Yeah, I found it very interesting that the way that Dean Smith has recycled or just changed up his coaching team, you know, that's something that, well, Fergie used to do, didn't he, on a regular basis. Is that a sign that Dean Smith is, you know, strategically moving along the pathway?
100%. I'm a huge fan of Dean Smith. I go back to my point earlier where this guy's not just started in management. He's got quite a lot of years behind him now. Obviously came through and ended up at Brentford, and we all know the kind of the positivity of the news around the Brentford project. Dean Smith was a big part of that. Thomas Frank, of course, was his assistant. So there's kind of continuity there. Thomas Frank hasn't just come in and worked miracles. The work was already being done there. And Dean Smith, I think, has had that experience, knowing how to build something and develop something. Didn't panic with the whole noise around Grealish. Clearly, it felt to me a bit like that Grealish move was, unlike Harry Kane, it felt like one that had been planned and expected for quite a long time, and Villa had done the work behind the scenes. I don't know about you guys, but the Danny Ings signing was one of those great signings that doesn't seem to happen in football. It seemed to come from nowhere. It's like, oh my God, how did that happen? But actually, I watched the Everton game last weekend, and actually Ings and Watkins didn't dovetail particularly well, I didn't think. And I thought, and they still won the game comfortably. Everton had their own problems. But I thought, if Villa are able to tee off Everton with there's development there, there's improvement in that team to come. I think someone like Douglas Luiz, I think, is an absolutely sensational player. John McGinn's looking back. He never, to me, never quite looked at his best last season, never seemed that fully fit. And then you've got people like Tyrone Mings, because they also changed formation, of course. And I think, you know, we saw Daniel Farker play around with the Norwich formation against Liverpool in the League Cup, and it was borderline disaster. Well, it wasn't borderline, it was just a disaster. But it seems that quietly Dean Smith is building a team that has a lot of talent, more strength in depth, and is flexible. And a team's ability, we talk about the flexibility of coaches, flexibility of formations. Players seem to know what they're doing. And I'm a huge fan of Villa. I mean, again, where's the ceiling? Can they break into the top four? Absolutely no chance. Can they be around in that kind of mix, you know, fifth to seventh and eighth? I think they could be. They could be. Granted, you know, a season of keeping the big guys fit.
Yeah, we see so much aid through the prism of the managers themselves. Now, I'm looking forward to the North London Derby on Sunday. Don't know about you.
Never look forward to it.
You know, with Arsenal under Arteta, there did seem to be a big mental hurdle overcome at Turf Moor at Burnley. What sort of state are they in going into the North London Derby on Sunday? You know, obviously they won against AFC Wimbledon in the League Cup. That's three consecutive clean sheets. Where are they? Are they, you know, because it was doom and gloom 2 weeks ago. Is it not quite as dark?
Look, Arsenal weren't as bad as they looked, but they're not all of a sudden an amazing side that is going to fly up the league, in my opinion. I'm absolutely not getting carried away. Arsenal have always been Norwich at home. It's happened, you know, they haven't lost to Norwich since the first year of the Premier League at home. They always avoid defeat at Burnley. They almost always win there. I think before I was born was the last time they lost at Burnley. So I'm not taking that much stock from those two performances. They were good results. Very much a work in progress. I think that there's not much swashbuckle to the play. There's not a lot of flair. The combinations that we used to see under Arsene Wenger, they're quite rare at the moment. The triangles, the movement. But it is coming. It is coming. And I'll tell you who the key man is to knit everything together, and that's Thomas Partey. Huge fan of him. I think that he will hold the team together. The way that he can protect the back four, he can drop into his own box to be a centre-half when teams cross the ball. I think that's really important. And on the ball, he is so smooth, just ridiculously smooth. And he will pick out Arsenal's forward players with better, earlier passes. And that in turn should help them create more opportunities, better opportunities. So for me, keeping Thomas Partey fit is the key to Arsenal's season. I think he's that important. But no, I think the team as a whole is lacking a bit of confidence and fluidity, but they'll get there. And the back four as well, while I'm on it, getting the first choice back four together is huge. Tomiyasu, Gabriel, White, Tierney, that's the back four. And I hope to see it almost every week.
With Ramsdale behind them?
Yeah, I do, yeah. I think that Aaron Ramsdale's played three matches and has been excellent in all of them. He's kept clean sheets in all of them. He looks really comfortable wearing the badge. Some players can be a bit nervous, can't they, stepping up and because of the pressure. But he looks really confident. We know he's a good shot stopper. Yeah, I think that, well, he's got the shirt. It's as simple as that. He's got the shirt until he loses it, in my opinion. Something's gone on, I suspect, behind the scenes with Bernd Leno, because I didn't see enough in his performances to suggest that he needed to be dropped. But they've made that call, and I think everyone's pretty comfortable with it, apart from Leno, of course.
I mean, sorry to do your job, Mike, but like you talk about that back four, like as that kind of, this is now the unequivocal first choice. Mm. We've barely seen Tomiyasu, really. Gabriel's, no. I mean, he's better than the other centre-backs at the club. But how good is he? I mean, do you look at that back four plus Ramsdale and think that's really a defence that can keep the top four out?
In the here and now, I think it's a defence that's an improvement on the previous incarnations, but it's not a top four defence yet. But what I will say is that Ramsdale is young. Tomiyasu is 22. The two centre-halves are 23. Tierney, I think, is 24. So these guys have got what I think are the best years of players' careers in the next 3 or 4 years. So what I'd like to see, providing they do their jobs properly, is that unit develop together. And I think they'll all improve as players together as well. So, yeah, it's not going to be Chelsea's defence just like that. It's just not going to be. Arsenal don't have that resource at the moment, do they, to go out and buy a world-class defender. They have to improve them.
Yeah, I find it interesting, you know, listening to Arteta talk about Odegaard's leadership qualities. Now, is that something that has been lacking in his squad to date, do you think, Tony?
I mean, it's been lacking in Arsenal's squad for years, hasn't it? I mean, we did some content with Freddie Ljungberg recently, and obviously we got him on the tactics board talking about the Invincibles. Why wouldn't you? But he went back to the squad that he came into, you know, and this was a constant, I mean, Aid knows more about this than me, but it seemed to be a constant theme in the latter Wenger years that he just didn't have leaders in that, certainly in the midfield. And when you think about the team that he inherited when he came in, obviously there was the famed back four and David Seaman, but then, you know, Vieira, I mean, people forget, Emmanuel Petit was hard as nails. He was a lovely footballer. And then obviously Gilberto came in, but and since probably Arteta himself, have they had that real leadership in midfield? And when you think about someone like Aubameyang being club captain, that just doesn't that doesn't, it's not Roy Keane, is it? Just doesn't strike me as someone who's going to come in. And Odegaard, again, he's a lovely player. And I haven't as yet seen kind of leadership potential that you want from a team that's going to challenge the top teams. Yeah, not convinced.
What about Spurs, aid looking across North London? Nuno has a reputation as a cautious coach. Is that reputation manifesting itself, do you think?
Yeah, I think if that's your sort of go-to, if that's your base, and it was at Wolves, wasn't it? Then he's not going to change. Obviously, the expectations at Spurs are higher. They need to score more goals. They need to win more games than he did at Wolves. But I think he's going to do that by using talent at his disposal, but giving them a defensive framework to sort of flourish with. I think that's been the key. He's gone in, and Spurs were a bit of a mess at the back. And the last two games, they've also been a bit of a mess at the back. But during pre-season and the first few games, that they did show signs of promise. He is a great organiser, Nuno. There's no doubt about that. He can make it really difficult for opposition teams in the way that his players cover the spaces, work ever so hard as well. So, yeah, they're going to be solid counter-attacking side under Nuno. That's how I see them. And given the players that they've got, because let's face it, they don't have many creative players, do they? It's a team of real pace merchants, hard-working midfielders. You know, Kane is the goal getter and the creator. They don't really have that many people to make chances. That for me means that they're limited in the way that they're going to play this season. It's going to have to be transitions, come alive, hurt teams.
They're almost the reverse of what you said about Arsenal, aren't they? They weren't as good as their first three results suggested, and nor are they quite as bad as their subsequent results have suggested. But again, I look at both of you. I think you never learn, talking about the weekend's game, you never learn that much about either team from the North London derby in terms of the season ahead. But I just look at them and just think that they look, this season, they look like also-rans already. And the problem that Nuno has is that the fans, they demand a certain amount of style and elan, and he was never going to bring that. I think when they played, you know, the way they played City at the start of the season, where they just countered, they had those three guys up top with loads of pace. They put them up top, they left them there, they countered with real pace, which was quite exciting. But it was against Manchester City where you can do that. When you go and play against teams who sit in a low block and say, well, we're not going to let you counter-attack, then that's the problem that Nuno has with Tottenham. And you just look at, and again, you know, that was that win against Man City was done without Kane. You know, he's not slow, but he brings something different, and you're not going to be able to counter-attack with the pace that you would if Kane's in the team. And it's just not right, is it? It's just like,
you're leaving him out, Tony. You're not leaving him out.
Oh no, I'm not leaving him out. Certainly wouldn't leave him out. But reality,
Tony, is beginning to bite with him, isn't it? It must do.
Yeah, yeah, and you wonder. You wonder what the future holds for Kane and Spurs, both this season and beyond. They haven't recovered from Pochettino's departure. They've never replaced Christian Eriksen, who was the creative heartbeat of that team. And, you know, Ndombele promised much. It isn't quite that same kind of creative force, but provides maybe that little bit of kind of star quality. But have we seen it often enough? Does Nuno trust him? Obviously not. Mourinho didn't really. And so where is that flair coming from? Where is that creativity to actually, the guile to break down teams? To me, it doesn't look like it exists. And I think we saw last season, didn't we? It was Kane dropping in, Son running in behind. And against a team like Southampton, he just refused to even try and do anything to stop that. It was brilliant. But against a lot of other opposition, if you set up properly, you know, you can deal with that. And I do wonder where we're going to go with Spurs. It's going to be. I'm really looking forward to the game at the weekend. Actually, I really have no idea what to expect.
I suspect low scoring. Neither team has been particularly free flowing, have they? So, yeah, I think this might be a one goaler either way, or maybe none.
Yeah. Well, what about a team close to your heart, Tony? Liverpool. You know, we spoke about them earlier in the week, and you know, we saw a team coming together, regaining its mojo, whatever phrase you want to use. Interesting game at Brentford. Thiago will be missing. Is he a bit worryingly fragile for you?
I mean, yeah, I guess there was a lot of talk when he signed that this was a guy who missed quite a lot of football. And he's one of these guys who his reputation almost increases when he's not playing, because we see these flashes of brilliance. I mean, his cameo against Everton before, I forget who it was, tried to kill him last season, was just beautiful. But he is, you know, the question marks over how he fits into Liverpool's kind of, you know, the whole kind of all-action style. Does he have those legs? I mean, when you watch him track back, it's actually, I find it almost enjoyable, because he just looks like he's running in a way that is different to everybody else, because he just isn't that athletic. But then, yeah, he does seem quite fragile. I mean, I love watching him. And, you know, last season wasn't about Thiago for Liverpool. It was about everything else going on around him. My instinct, and I hate to say it, but my instinct is that Liverpool will probably always be a better team when they've got three all-action midfielders who can get around the pitch very quickly. And that probably isn't Thiago. So much as it's a shame that he's not fit, I look at the team as it is, and I think that, you know, if everyone was fit, we saw at the start of the season, Harvey Elliott was probably being picked ahead of him.
Well, and you know, you look at, you know, Joel Matip, there's a similar issue there with you know, the injuries jumping up and biting him on a fairly regular basis. In view of that, aid a potential central defensive partnership of Van Dijk and Ibrahima Konate, does that work for you?
Well, they're both quick, aren't they? And that would suit the style in terms of pressing high up the pitch. And we know that leaving a high line has caused Liverpool problems in the past, especially last season, on numerous occasions. So no, it's a good option. Is it the best partnership? Not in my opinion. I really like the Van Dijk-Matip partnership, actually. I really like it. Two tall guys that are giants at set pieces. And don't ignore that, because Liverpool obviously have been dynamite from them, haven't they, so far this season. And I think that's because, you know, they're sending up those two plus what they've already got. I just think that they're a really graceful pairing that click. Obviously, Gomez is in the mix as well. So, look, that, yeah, it's a total turnaround, isn't it, from last year where they had no centre-halves. It's, yeah, poor old Nathaniel Phillips. I mean, you got to feel for him, because, you know, he did a sterling job at times last season, but he's fifth choice, isn't he, now?
What about the lessons of Brentford's development, Tony? You know, I think it's significant that there seem to be few doubts about their ability to adapt and survive in the Premier League, which is the contrast to, say, Norwich. They look pretty forlorn already. It's an innovative system. What do you make of it?
I really like it. I really like Thomas Frank. I think this is a project that's been going on for some time, and it's interesting to compare it to Norwich, because we've done some work with Norwich in the academy. Norwich is a really, really well-run club. And the key word for Norwich is sustainability. And their model is bring players through, sell players, fund the club, bring more players through, sell players, fund the club. And it's not about being a Premier League club. It's about being a well-run, sustainable club. And actually, and I'll go back to Brentford in a minute, but actually, if you look at the Norwich team right now, it's probably 1-11, their first choice. It's probably weaker than it was 2 years ago. They don't have... Buendia's obviously gone. I think we all agree he's a lovely player. He's gone to Villa. Even last season, they had Oliver Skipp, who was a complete dynamo in midfield, and they haven't really got that. They've got Billy Gilmore this season, who hasn't really hit the ground running, struggled a bit, and he's probably a slightly different kind of player. A lovely player, but if they're not dominating possession, and they defensively, they just don't look good enough to me. Whereas it feels like Brentford, this is a long-term project that has been based not around being, well, obviously being run sustainable, but being a Premier League club, being ready to be in the Premier League, probably not going up the season before, in a strange way, probably helped them a little bit. They were able to consolidate, develop, bring more players through, get a bit more experience. We know they sell players. Ollie Watkins is a great example, but they just look so well managed, well run, well coached. And I mean, I'm with you guys. I don't see them struggling.
And Thomas Frank, Mike, has adapted the tactics according to the opposition. In the Championship, they were pretty much an attack-minded possession team. Lovely build-up play, use the wings. They could go direct at times, but they were by and large a possession-based front-foot side. They are now disruptors. That's why they're brilliant at it. They've become, over the course of this summer, a side that isn't really that bothered about building up play, keeping possession for long periods. They've become a team that focus on shape, working hard to close down the opposition, force mistakes, and then when they get it, they go long to Tonian and Bramo, who are a massive handful for anyone, as we saw in the opening night. So they've pretty much ripped up Plan A and gone for a new Premier League Plan A. It's brilliant, and that's what Norwich haven't done. Daniel Farke wants to play the Norwich way in the Championship, in the Premier League. If we go down doing it, no worries. We'll continue doing our thing. Brentford have adapted to the level.
Yeah, when you think of Farke, he's suffered 15 straight Premier League defeats, albeit a promotion season in between. You must have to have a strategic commitment to the manager for the managers to survive that sort of run. Norwich are at Everton at the weekend, Tony. Rafa Benitez, there've been murmurings from day one, to put it mildly. Loss in the League Cup at QPR didn't help his case. You know, I know it's daft to talk about must wins at this time of season, but really they could do with a win at the weekend, couldn't they, on Saturday?
Yeah, I think they'll probably get it. I mean, the one thing you can guarantee about Rafa is that he just doesn't listen to the murmurings. I mean, I always go, he just doesn't care. Which I love the guy for personal reasons with his Liverpool connection. And I think those murmurings are always going to go. But I mean, he went to Chelsea where they absolutely despise him. Yeah. And he did a really good job for them and didn't care what the fans thought. I just think he's made the right noises since going in there. I think he's behaved, you know, respectfully. He's got, you know, obviously Duncan Ferguson's in there and he's worked with him and seems to have him on board. But just, you know, when you get key players out, Calvert-Lewin, Richarlison, obviously James Rodriguez is not really there in his heart and spirit anymore, is he? But it's Rafa. He just, you know, obviously you look at kind of Mourinho and the question marks about whether he's still got it. And, you know, Rafa's from that kind of era and you think, oh, is he a bit behind the times? Obviously a defensive-minded coach, you know, again, kind of transition-based rather than possession-based. But he's just a guy who gets the job done. He is, and they might finish 7th or 8th this season, but that's still an improvement on last season. And the question again for Everton is, what do you want to be as a club? What are their aspirations? The fans would want more than that, but right now, where are they and what can they achieve? And I'm not sure they can do much more than that.
No, I think they've got to look a bit deeper, haven't they, in terms of, I think it's 267 million spent recently in the transfer market. There's a lot of people looking at Marcel Brands, who's the sporting director there, and saying, well, are you doing your job, chum?
Fair comment. I think their best player is someone that came in on a very low fee from the lower leagues, and Dominic Calvert-Lewin at a young age. And I think that so much revolves around him, really. And yeah, I would. Last weekend, they were torn apart by Villa, but they were really weakened, severely weakened. And I think until they get some of the key men back, it'll be hard to judge. I actually I've quite enjoyed their sort of fast transitions and counter-attacking football. I love the fact that the wingers, Gray and Townsend, have been revitalised under Rafa. That's been brilliant to see. But yeah, no, I think Marcel Brands, all eyes are on him. He has sanctioned moves for players that are no better than mid-table, and he spent over £200 million doing it. And for that reason, I think that he might end up losing his job. They haven't got those young players that they can develop, that are really talented, that they can develop. They haven't bought those kind of players. They've bought players at the top of their own values, and that, I think, was a big mistake.
Yeah, Burnley, Tony, they're at Leicester on Saturday. Sean Dyche has just committed himself to a new contract at the club. This is probably an unfair question, but is it that's a tacit admission that he's limited because of, you know, what I would consider to be an unfair reputation?
The short answer to that is yes. at least in my view. Again, it's a, it, it, at the risk of repeating myself, he just reminds me a little bit of Benitez. He'll just get the job done. They'll finish somewhere between 14th and 16th this season, 17th maybe. They won't go down. They'll be really difficult to play against for the majority of the teams. They'll have some bad results. They'll look like they're in trouble. They'll pull a few out and that'll be that, and they'll go again. He's a very, very, very good manager. He's a very good, he knows what he wants. He knows the kind of players he wants. He knows the style of football he's going to play. Nobody likes playing against those strikers. They just do, whoever it is. But you know, Chris Wood was the main troublemaker last season. Ashley Barnes, kind of when he was fit, and obviously they've got Mate Vidra and others. But the question mark with Sean Dyche every season is it coming to an end? Is it done? Is it all going a bit stale? And everyone thinks yes, it is, and then it isn't. So I'm perfectly prepared for exactly the same to happen this season. The new contract, you're probably right. Bit of protection from the club, maybe thinking that, you know, a bit like players sign up to a longer contract, and if they do go, there's a bit of compensation for us. But he's never linked with any of the jobs that come up anymore, really, is he? You don't really see, if Rafa went, for example, from Everton, you really wouldn't see Sean Dyche linked with it. So
he's perfect for Burnley. I just think he's certain players, certain managers just fit a place, don't they? And I just think he is perfect for Burnley. Given the style that he's used at Burnley, it just would be too much of a gamble. Even if he made a really convincing case that I would adapt the style and become more entertaining with better players at my disposal, even if he made that case, it would be an almighty gamble from any of the sides that want to play a very different style to appoint him. I just don't see him anywhere other than Burnley. You know, it would be Watford, Palace, Newcastle, maybe. I can't think of a Premier League team that would approach him. But that's not because he's not good at his job, because he's brilliant at his job. So, but that's just where he finds himself, I guess. He's typecast, isn't he?
I mean, for want of a better phrase, it's the same point as with Pep at City, isn't it? Who follows him? Like the worry is not where Dyche goes next; it's where Burnley go next.
Yeah.
As and when Dyche goes, if he ever leaves. But it's that has worked. The chemistry of that manager at that club has worked so well. It's hard to see who follows him.
What about Wolves? You know, you look at, we talk about managers or head coaches, whatever term that they answer to. I look at Wolves as a fantastic blue collar club, great support, fantastic stadium. Yeah, I don't know what its identity is anymore. Is that typified by the appointment of Bruno Lage, who doesn't really seem to have pulled up too many trees?
I think give this guy a chance, Bruno Lage. That's my response really to that. I don't know. I thought in the first few weeks, even though they lost their games, that it was a different Wolves. It was a much more fun Wolves. Certainly more ambitious, more attack-minded, less constrained by tactical, you know, instruction, perhaps. I liked what I was seeing, but they just couldn't score. I think it's a really hard job at the moment, because they've got... Jota was massive for them, gone. Raul Jimenez, just the main man, and he isn't the same at the moment. He is taking his time to come back. And Traore, for all his speed, that doesn't deliver those goals and assists, does he? Just doesn't. And arguably their best current player, and in my opinion, he is their best current player, Pedro Neto, is out long term. So I think it's a terrible time to take over Wolves, and that. But this guy, he might be good. I think he's different to Nuno in terms of what he wants from the team. And that for me is what they needed.
They lost their first three games 1-0, didn't they? And actually, I would say in five of the six halves in those games, they were the better team. And they just couldn't score. I mean, there was a crazy stat that they had more shots on target than any other team in the Premier League, who just hadn't scored. They then got the win. The worry for me was watching them against Brentford, where they were really second best. And they looked, and their success under Nuno was built on a really, really strong defence. Again, transitions, counter-attacking at pace, and built on a number nine, who for me was as good as anyone in the league in that position, Jimenez, before his injury. And he's right, he definitely isn't. Who knows what he will be, what he can be, but he definitely isn't where he was before. The problem against Brentford, they looked defensively, they looked like there were holes. And if that's going to continue to happen and they can't convert the chances at the other end, then they're going to be in trouble. I'm with Aid, actually. I've quite liked what I've seen in places, and I think it's too early to question Bruno Larger, but you get a few more 1-0 defeats or a few more Brentford repeats and you know, noises are going to happen, aren't they?
Yeah, we'll go from Nuno to who knows, I suppose. Just to bring it all together, chaps, you know, we've spoken a lot about coaches and managers in this edition. Something caught my eye from Julian Nagelsmann. Just like your thoughts on it, please. This quote: American football is much more technologically advanced than football. The quarterback has an earpiece to hear his coach. We absolutely need that. Football must stop hiding behind tradition and revolutionise itself. Bold words. What do you reckon about them? Aid, first.
Look, I have a lot of respect for Nagelsmann's coaching, for his CV, what he's achieved for someone so young. But his taste in suits is rotten. And so is this idea. It's terrible. I mean, earpieces, they make sense for coaches. Of course they do. Because you can't hear much during the course of the game. But football's a very different sport to American football. It's far less pre-planned. It's not programmable. And too much information, I think, certainly in my case when I used to play, too much information stifled me. I just felt like I inhibited. I don't think that's progress. I really don't. I think there are other ways we can progress the sport, but not this. I mean, football's pure. You want spontaneous brilliance. The game is about players. The game is about players producing moments of magic. It's not about coaches micromanaging every single situation on the pitch. So, Julian, bin that idea, please. It's terrible.
Mm. What about you, Tom?
Absolute nonsense. I mean, there's a few things to say about it. One is that American football, one, they have big helmets that mean that the earpieces don't fall out. And you're talking only coach to quarterback. I mean, American football is a team sport, but the importance of the quarterback is so unique in the world of sport. Who are you gonna put the earphones in football? You know, the centre mid, the centre back, the keeper, all of them. Are you just screaming at the whole team all the time? Like, and also the other thing about it that I think is a kind of just. He's just kind of prodding a bear, isn't he? But football is progressing. Football is innovating. What I found interesting this week was two things, I should say. One is that when Steve Cooper was first linked with the Nottingham Forest job, you get used, don't you, to coaches going into new jobs and taking their traditional backroom staff with them, whether that's an assistant coach or a doctor or whatever. First name that was mentioned was a guy called Steve Rans, who was his lead analyst at Swansea. Like, the importance of the analyst is now... It's almost like he's the first person that a manager goes to. You talk about kind of communication and the messages that players have. We had a webinar with Jack Ross, the Hibs manager, earlier this week, and he talked about his relationship with his analyst. And he said that his analyst would deliver him from a game between or ahead of a game 10 to 13 minutes of footage, of analysis of the opposition. Jack would then work with his analyst to distill that down to between 6 and 8 minutes, and that would be what the players got. But there's a week of work in that. Like, go back 10, 15 years, that didn't exist. This is where football is modernising. You don't need earpieces in players' ears. I wonder whether he was just having a bit of fun with it, really, but it's definitely nonsense for me.
I'll tell you what used to happen at Arsenal. You used to walk in on a match day, you see the team sheet pinned up on the wall, and then you see the other team pinned up on their wall with, I would say, two lines max about each player, strengths, weaknesses, and that was all that we were fed. So progress is being made, undoubtedly. The analysts are fantastic.
Yeah, well, the game as a whole should never stand still, should it? And, you know, there are, as Tony said there, innovations happening across English football in recruitment, player development, and, of course, there are more specialist coaches than ever. You know, like the guys, I hate to think that football could ever become a pre-programmed game like gridiron. I still believe in instinct and emotion. And there has to be room for individualism as well as innovation. Hope you agree with me. In the meantime, thanks to Tony and Adrian for their insight. And thank you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.